This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, rescue language's kite from a tree. Today's episode is something a bit different to usual. A few months ago, I was a guest on the podcast Ologies, a terrific show where the very funny and delightful and curious Ali Ward interviews an ologist of some kind, such as a bisonologist, an ologist of bison, ludologist, video games, a corvid thanatologist, an ologist of crow funerals. Ali interviewed me as an etymologist, and I'm not a professional etymologist, just an amateur. The etymology of amateur is lover, which is appropriate too. We cover etymologies of words including buxom, mediocre, coccyx, lacuna, and also some broader stuff about language and my attitude towards it. There are a couple of swears in it. On with Zaltzology, and Ali's first question was about my last name.
Do people put an extra L in there a lot?
No, actually, that is not one of the regular spelling mistakes, but they see the Z's and they panic.
Do you say Z as in Z or zebra?
Well, I say Z when I'm in Z-saying countries, but I'm on your turf, so I've translated it.
Look at that. Do you say zebra?
I do say zebra. Is it zebra here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so here's my rubric for when I'm in the States. If it's a different word, like Z, Z, or coriander, cilantro, I'll say the different word, but it is harder for me to use the correct American pronunciation if it's the same word. So it's hard for me to say tomato because it sounds just wrong when I say it. Like I can't do it properly. Like my mouth won't form a proper American shape to do the word properly.
Tomato, tomato, oh, let's call the whole thing off.
Tomato sounds so much fancier.
I don't know. I think
it does.
Even an English word. Got it from South America.
Quick aside, the word tomato comes from the Nahuatl, a language of what's known historically as the Aztec Empire, for the swelling fruit. And thus, a tomato is what people called a hot girl in the 1920s. Language experts think this is due to plump, juicy connotations.
Now, how long have you been interested in language?
I remember first becoming interested in language when I was fairly small. I was, I think, 7, and I went to very old-fashioned school, so I started learning French and Latin at a very young age. And I was like, oh, that word seems similar to this word in English. And it was a bit like when you see Homeland or something where someone's got a wall with lots of newspaper clippings joined together with string.
You understand.
It's a timeline.
Yes. So I was like, I wonder if these have got things in common. And also I grew up in quite a verbose household. So I was the youngest. I was an accident. So there's quite a bit of time between me and my elder brothers, who are both very witty and good at talking. And I just thought, God, if I'm going to say anything, then I really have to bring my A game. So it was just a form of survival to be verbally deft from a young age.
Did you talk early?
I don't know, because I don't think anyone was paying attention. But apparently I was an early reader. My mum says I was an early reader, but I remember her teaching me to read. So I think before that I was just looking at books with the appearance of reading.
You just had to, they're like, why is she wearing bifocals? She's 2.
I did have glasses from 1.5. How did you know?
Did you really?
Yeah, not bifocals till I was 14. I mean, yeah.
You started losing that nearsighted.
Yeah, it was. There are not many pictures of my childhood.
Really?
Yeah, I had these sort of like pink plastic thick glasses. And then sometimes they would put a Band-Aid over one lens to strengthen the other eye.
Really?
Well, they used to put it over my eye, but then ripping it off is quite painful.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a good time.
Babies in glasses are the cutest babies.
Sort of. I think glasses styles have improved.
No, they're always, babies in glasses are always cute.
Is it like babies that look like angry little old men? Like who look like old codgers? Babies?
Yes, exactly.
That's a good fun.
They're a kinder codger.
Yeah. Or like a baby wearing a tiny bow tie.
Yes. I guess like an old man in like a diaper with a pacifier isn't as cute. But when you reverse it, it's good, you know?
So unfair.
Okay. So some of the OED's added words this year, by the by, were TGIF, burkini, and haterade.
Some interesting choices.
Do you keep up with the OED each year with the new words added?
No, because I think that's usually a press release bit of game.
don't you? Because they just want to annoy people with
that's
that
a good point.
Often.
They're usually the most annoying words.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they know they're trolling people.
Oh, God, that's so sinister and wonderful.
Yeah, I like the relish with which a lot of the dictionaries have taken to the social media age. A lot of them have very salty Twitter accounts.
Oh, God, yes.
And you learn some good words. But also, the print edition of dictionaries, there's a limit to the number of words they can put in there. So some have to go. It's difficult for words to enter, but there's a lot of room on the internet, so they can track those words, and something that may only be briefly useful, like on fleek,
mm-hmm.
that can enter the dictionary quickly, but it doesn't necessarily have to stay there if it was just, you know, a few years of on fleekness.
On fleek sounds so much better coming with a British accent.
I only ever say it in quotation marks.
Right.
I've never managed to say it in an actually descriptive way.
I don't think anyone other than the original Vine poster.
Yeah. Abraz on fleek.
Peaches really Monroe.
Is that what her name is?
Yeah.
Good job. How do you know that?
Well, I have first studied the etymology of on fleek.
That's why you're the best.
Oh, gosh. But yeah, I'm too old. I'm too old to say it without the quotation marks.
Yeah, we all are. Now, is there something about the elasticity of language? I feel like that's kind of what we all love about etymology, but is your interest rooted in human behavior and how we keep morphing things?
Yes, my interest very much in human behavior. And I think that's what partly got me interested in etymology in the first place, was just a lot of it is a little idiosyncratic, and you can see these signs of how people would have behaved several hundred years ago. So there's a lot of mistakes in how words have evolved. It's not necessarily logical. And I think that was appealing, that it's not these straight paths. Another thing I learned about doing the show was that I'm not a language prescriptivist. I was such a pedant when I was a child. It was just a nightmare, particularly to my mum.
Oh, no.
And now that, but it's unsustainable. When you know anything about how language behaves, you can't keep it up because there's just so many things contradicting it. And there's a lot of cognitive dissonance if you want to keep up your pedantry. But also after a while, I was like, you're carrying around a lot of pointless anger. it's just not necessary. So that was a positive surprise, I think. It was just being amenable to how language is going to change and has always changed, particularly the English language. That has evolved in much more rapidly than a lot of other languages that are deliberately kept the same. But if you know about English, you're like, okay, this is what happens. People use it the ways that they need it to be used. So if there is a gap, then people will fill it with either a word that they've decided to use in a different way, or they will invent one.
Gretchen, stop trying to make fetch happen.
And, you know, a lot of it is driven by that kind of necessity. You can't control it. And even if it doesn't necessarily make sense, it's never made sense. And so you might not like it, but you have to understand that this is a linguistic process.
Now, what is it about English that has made it evolve so rapidly? And also, having studied Latin, where do you see we grab the roots from? Latin, from Greek?
Oh, yeah. English is such a mutt of a language, which is why it's so fascinating. It's a problem as well, which is more to do with its later history. So English kind of came about originally from a bunch of invasions. So there were native languages in the British Isles, but then there was the Roman invasion, which I think was 50 BC to about 400 AD. And then Germanic forces invaded around 500 AD, and then Vikings, and then 1066, the Normans. So you get a lot of French influence, but also a lot of Latin through French. And so at that point you had like the language of governance being Latin, but then the language of posh people being French, but then like kind of normal people still speaking Anglo-Saxon, which is like quite a Germanic version of Anglo-Saxon. And then that kind of coalesces into Middle English that then becomes Modern English. So I think about 70% of English words have some Latin roots, but a lot of those Latin roots would have come from Greek, or they didn't come directly from the Romans. And then you've got what I call euphemistically Britain's enthusiastic foreign policy. So it was not only people coming in and invading the country, it's also us going to other parts of the world, a lot of other parts of the world, and sticking our dicks in them.
And, pretty much.
Yeah. So English has happened in lots of different places, but also we found words in those places and brought them back. Or, you know, we brought back things we found, like potatoes, and thus the word with them. So that happens a ton. So you've got like this very idiosyncratic thing. Whereas French, you've got an academy keeping French the same. So they decide on whether you're allowed gender neutral pronouns or whatever. They don't like this. It's a very gendered language. Whereas English doesn't have that kind of control and has resisted that kind of control. They've tried and it hasn't really taken off.
What are some of your favorite etymologies? Because there's a story behind all of them.
Yes, although frustratingly often the story is like, we don't know.
Yeah.
the pathway doesn't go very far. I really like the etymology of the word mediocre, and I don't know why it is, but it means halfway up a jagged hill.
Really?
Yeah. What an evocative thing.
God, I never knew that one.
And is it, does that, because I would have thought to get halfway up a jagged hill, you have to be really quite good.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like an easy path, or just like the absence of any particular quality. It seems like a hard climb.
Yeah. How many jagged hills were these people climbing?
I don't know.
It must be quite a lot. If you can only get halfway up, was a burn.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, well, we just scampered right to the top before breakfast. So I find that very fascinating, and I don't understand why it is. Seems like quite the story.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Have you ever heard the etymology for buxom?
No, that sounds fun.
Such a good one. This is one of my favorite etymologies. It comes from pliable, and then compliant, and then friendly, and then beautiful, and then sexy, and then boobs.
Wow. So it wasn't that the boobs were pliable.
No.
So the person was pliable, and that's a sexy trait to some.
Evidently, yeah.
Wow.
So, which is one of those weird twists and turns that you're just thinking about it having to morph at every stage of the way.
Yeah.
When it comes to like a goal with etymology, do you feel like with language, you can use your platform to have people see each other differently? Do you ever feel like you can fix some ills of the world with language?
Yeah, when I'm feeling evangelical. I think, so it is an entertainment show first and foremost, and it's supposed to distract people on a commute or when they can't sleep or when they're feeling anxious or whatever. But then it's just when you get into language and you're thinking about all the different ways it can be used, I think a lot of it is about empathy, because the more sensitive you become to all that, you become more aware of your own usage and how other people might interpret it and the various things they might mean with their usage. So it forces you to think about other people more and their communication and the endless variety thereof. And also just if you get into your hang-ups, you can often realize that a lot of them are about snobbery or a way of controlling people almost by telling them that they're saying something in a way you disagree with. Mm-hmm. And so removing yourself from that or encouraging other people just to not focus on that. I think that is quite important because it's just more compassionate.
And the etymology of compassionate, it's late Latin for calm plus patti, so to suffer together. And yes, the root of passion is to suffer, but compassion is to feel the pain of others, which is terribly moving.
So I'd say that is the more serious thing.
Up next, Ali asked me some questions posed by her listeners.
What was the last word that you learned? Do you remember?
Oh, there are words that I have to look up every time, like lacuna. I just cannot remember what lacuna means.
It's a great, great word. You know how I learned that word? Did you ever see Eternal Sunshine?
I did. And that was how I learned of the word, but I still haven't.
The best. A lacuna, are you ready for this? It's a bookbinding term, meaning a chunk of the glued pages that have detached from the spine and are missing. And in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which was written by the genius Charlie Kaufman, the company that can wipe away specific memories is called Lacuna Incorporated.
But why remember a destructive love affair? Here at Lacuna, we have perfected a safe, effective technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories.
Just can't, it just won't fix in my mind.
Well, there's a blank spot where lacuna should be.
Yeah.
There's a lacuna.
Ah!
Where there's a lacuna.
That's how to remember it. Thank you.
Boom.
You really guided me through that.
Bob White.
Hi, Bob.
Just says, this is an imperative, not even an inquisitive. Explain Q. Q-U-E-U-E.
Well, it's where you stand in line with people. In French, we got the word from French. In French, is pronounced que and means tail. So that's very cute, isn't it? Like a dog's little que.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yeah.
I do love that having context for all these words, it's like seeing someone's face and being like, okay, and then getting to know them as a person. Do you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Katie Cobb, why is the F word so versatile?
It's a great word, isn't it? A lot of the swears are very flexible, but particularly that one, because it can be noun, verb.
Yes.
Affectionate, sexual, insult. Yeah, it's very handy.
Yeah, what is the fucking etymology of that word?
Oh, that is a hard one to know because it's old, but also because it's kind of slangy. So when people make up an acronym for it, it's definitely not an acronym. It's like hundreds of years older than that. But a lot of the etymologies of swears are just a bit unsatisfactory because they don't really know. But it wasn't such a rude word as it is now. Like the C-bomb wasn't such a rude word as it is now. Like that's religious swears were more rude in like 14th century when these swears were around, and body parts and sexual ones, not so much as the religious ones. But yeah, I think when people are down on swearing, you just think, well, what word can you use in as many varied ways as the F-bomb?
It is the Swiss Army knife of cussing. There's nothing it can't do.
That is a wonderful way to describe it.
I still can't say the C word. That's not a word that comes... Oh. I mean, I think that's more of a British word, but...
Yeah, I didn't realize... That's been very educational to me, making this show about language. Just, I knew that there were differences in American vocabularies versus English, but I was less aware of the nuances of usage because I hadn't spent as much time in the States. And there are certain things you don't realize until they're pointed out. I think the fourth episode, The Illusionist, was about the C-bomb. And in Britain... Like it is a strong swear. It's one of the strongest, but you still get people who kind of, it can be an affectionate one. Like, ah, you old C-bomb. In context, you wouldn't say that to someone you weren't very confident would understand the intent.
Of course.
Yeah.
This almost dovetails, but Danielle Riviera asks, what is your biggest word-related pet peeve?
Oh, I have a lot, but I'm always trying to confront my prejudices. And some of them I think will never leave, but I can just not give them more room. And then others have really dissipated over the years. But at the moment, I am really keeping an eye on the word community. And I think that people using it should think, is there another word I can use? Because I think it's being used thoughtlessly. And so when people say the black community or the gay community, that sounds like it's 40 people that meet in a village hall and they all have the same viewpoint. And I can understand why something might be quite specific. So you might have the gay community in a particular city, but when you're talking about millions of people, it's too small a word for that. And I heard someone say the female community, and I was like, that is half the world. That is not appropriate. So if you're using community, I think there are different nouns you could use or different ways to reframe like the adjective that you're using. Like science community, you could say scientists. So part of it to me is an efficiency thing, but partly also there's a kind of condescension in it sometimes. And I'm always thinking, why is that there? Mm-hmm. What's it covering over? But then it's like, what are you trying to say with such a big generalization? Should you break that down a bit more?
Mm-hmm. So it indicative of perhaps what you're saying doesn't reflect the thoughts of everyone.
Right. Just be careful of the generalizations. Yeah.
God, that's a great note. Danielle Rivera also wants to know how many people assume that you study insects or that you have a podcast about bugs. Oh, yeah,
quite a lot. And confusingly, right behind your head are some beautiful insects.
I have a big, gross dead bug collection on one wall of my apartment, and I'm just realizing how creepy that must be for visitors. But Helen is very wonderful, and she's compassionate. But yes, etymology and entomology.
But I can understand why people would mix them up because they're not exactly words you need in your everyday vocabulary.
No.
And I wouldn't necessarily remember if I didn't particularly care about either.
Oh, sure. Yeah. They're not, they don't roll off the tongue often.
So when people get it wrong, I think, well, at least they tried.
Yeah, they tried. They're so close.
They busted out a tricky word.
So close. That'd be like if someone bought you a shoe and it was a 7.5 and not an 8. Oh. You'd be like, look at how close it is. Yeah. Ivy Crutchfield wants to know, can you ask her the origin of coccyx?
Oh, this is good, actually. It's from the Greek word cuckoo. supposedly called by the ancient Greek physician Galen, who was very influential in the history of medicine, because the bone in humans supposedly resembles a cuckoo's beak. Wow.
Your butt bone's a bird beak.
Well, isn't that nice and alliterative?
Boom.
There you go.
I'm so glad they asked. Thanks, Ivy.
Lovely question.
Mads Clement wants to know, what's the best way to take down linguistic prescriptivists? Every time someone's like, that's a made up word, I want to do murder.
Yeah, well, all the words are made up, ultimately.
There you go.
Yeah. Language evolves and you can't stop it. But you can be swept away by the tide if you just stand there not moving.
I like that idea. M. Maurer wants to know, what is your opinion on starting essays with Webster's Dictionary defines excess?
That is desperate. Yeah, don't do it. And also, don't start anything with, it is a truth universally acknowledged in a Pride and Prejudice riff, because I see a lot of journalists starting articles with that and I'm like, you're out of ideas. What happens in the next paragraph if you're trying to do that beginning? Mm-hmm. What happens next? And then you could work back to opening with something more relevant.
So that's tired, played out, done.
It's rather tired and played out, but also what is it you're trying to say by citing that? It feels like, you know, that's your training wheels and you're not ready to take them off your bike.
Anna Thompson mentioned the unnecessary use, and someone else answered that about back in the day when you took out an ad in a paper, they charged by the letter of the neighbors. And
oh, unfortunately, that is made up, but it's a really wonderful story that I appreciate. It is just that American English is somewhat more streamlined than British English, which I appreciate. So British English might have the use because it's like, oh, a lot of those words came from French. And in American English, you're like, why do we need it? Because you can't hear it. It doesn't add anything. Get rid of it. Or like theater, you know, ER, rather than we have it still RE. And it doesn't make sense that we still have that. But I think we're in England still attached to the past and have resisted attempts to make the language more logical. Whereas in the States, you're less fettered by that history.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I totally bought the thing that it was.
It's a great story. A lot of the really attractive stories, unfortunately, are false because it's easier to make up a great story than to actually have one in life.
Well, then you've just debunked some flim flam.
Oh, shit.
I have loved that.
Puncturing dreams, that's me.
No, I loved it. Carrie Stoddard wants to know, are there any synonyms for the most hated word, moist?
Moist. Do you hate the word moist?
I'm, at this point, it's an underdog.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, can moist live? Can it just do its business? I don't hate it.
It's fine.
I don't hate it. I tend to think of like dew or grass more than I think of.
Well, that's a lovely form of moisture. I suppose the people who hate it are maybe thinking of bodily crevices.
I think.
And that's their prejudice showing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Because other words as well, like damp. I mean, if you're moist from the rain, like a raincoat, damp. Sure. Is that better? Is that worse? A bodily crevice could also be damp.
Sure. I feel like moist has a certain heat to it that damp lacks.
Sort of steaminess rather than chilliness. It's good that we're figuring these things out.
Anyone who hates that word, hopefully you hate it more now. Tyler Q says, why are a lot of science-based words like species names said in Latin?
That's a really good question. Partly, I think, because it's kind of an international language. So scientists might not all speak English or French or German or whoever discovered a thing, but they might have all tapped into Latin. I think the other thing is that Latin still has a lot of status, even though the Roman Empire kind of collapsed 1600-ish years ago. So people associate it with study, intelligence. It was propagated by religion, by Christianity being performed in Latin, and by kind of high-level politics and stuff like that. That has helped propagate Latin for hundreds of years after the Roman Empire fell apart. But it still has this reputation of things being classier and more intelligent. And that is a really good con to pull.
It's a long con.
It's a long con. And it's still happening. People are still coining new Latin words. There's a radio station in Finland I made an episode about that has done a news broadcast in Latin every week since 1989. And obviously words like aeroplane have no Latin equivalents. Yeah. So they have to make those up, and computer. But I interviewed a guy who coins words for that. And he was saying, well, it's no different really to how computer didn't exist in English. And then it had to be invented when people started having computers or internet.
Yeah.
So actually, it's fine. Showed me.
I mean, I remember learning Latin. We just learned so many words for kill. You could kill by bludgeoning. Yeah, there were so many but of course it was
useful.
Yeah, I mean, in those times.
Yeah, it's really indicative of what they were interested in.
Yes.
Yeah, we didn't learn anything that interesting. How disappointing.
Oh, it was I just remember being like, this is quite gory.
Yeah.
Just another word for kill.
Yeah.
Just slightly different ways.
So many inventive ways to destroy a person.
Do you have a favorite thing about word origins?
Do I? Favorite thing. I like when someone has a rigid idea about how things should be, and there's just so many examples in history of why they're not like that. That's useful to me.
Disproving people.
See if I can just transform society through the medium of light entertainment that's about words.
I would say that you already are, and thank you for doing that.
No, you're so welcome.
Thank you for doing this. Thank you for sharing so many words with me.
It is so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yay, etymology.
Yay, etymology and entomology.
And entomology, yes. Thanks for not being bugged by it.
Hey.
I know you hate puns, I'm sorry.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is rantipole, archaic noun, a foolish, reckless person. Try using it in an email today. Ologies is hosted and begat by Ali Ward. Subscribe to it in the podcast emporiums. You can hear the full-length version of this conversation, twice as long, on there, as well as many other kinds of ologists. There are so many ologies, I didn't even know existed. I think if you like The Allusionist, Ologies is very much your kind of show, so go check it out. Sorry to report that since Ali and I recorded together, the Finnish radio news bulletin in Latin, Nunti Latini, ended production after nearly 30 years. You can hear about it in the Latin Lives episode of The Allusionist. You can find The Allusionist on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. The handle is Allusionist Show. And hear every episode, read transcripts, find out more information about episode topics, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words at theallusionist.org.